fleeting glimpses of things seen through a veil, darkly. Do we understand the meaning of these visions of life? Why we are here and how little of our existence we truly understand? Tonight we will talk of these things on The Other Side. Welcome to The Other Side. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you once again. And today we have a great guest and we're looking forward to speaking with him about his recent book, Belonging to God, Science, Spirituality, and a Universal Path of Divine Love. And Dr. Kiepen is very well steeped in all of this. He is a mathematical physicist, an environmental scientist, and a practitioner on the contemplative path of divine love for 35 years. He has founded an institute dedicated to it with his wife. He conducts trainings, retreats, and workshops nationally and internationally, encouraging individuals, communities, and organizations to combine the inner work of the heart with outer service in the world. Dr. William Kiepen, welcome to the program today.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's a joy to be here.
I have to ask, how does someone go from being a mathematical physicist to being fascinated in these spiritual realms?
Well, that's a question I get asked a lot. And, you know, the short answer is that I've always seen science as a quest for truth. And although science normally focuses on the outer physical universe, there's another whole domain of inquiry, which is the inner realms of the heart, if you will. And so my short answer to that question is that science is a quest for truth. The deepest truth is love, and the most profound form of love is divine love. And so in a certain way, it's been a rather natural trajectory for me.
Now, let me ask you this because, and I ask this question to a lot of our guests, we're in a very hectic world these days. You know, we all walk around with our smartphones and we're constantly plugged in. You know, I guess Timothy Leary said what, tune in, turn out, and drop out. I always get that wrong.
Right.
But anyway, you know what he said.
Exactly.
And I hope the audience knows what he said. Basically, it's the idea of extracting yourself. But we're also plugged in. We're also tuned in to all of this stuff that we do. I mean, how in the world can we find time and find a way to take a more spiritual path? How can we do that?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. And the Dalai Lama was asked that once from a woman who said, you know, I've got three kids and I get up in the morning and they're up before I am and I've got to get going and there's no time to do these practices. And his response to her was, well, I could be said to be a busy man. and then he outlined the number of hours per day that he is able to meditate. So we have to basically prioritize what matters most to us in our lives. And if we carve out even a small amount of time, say 20 minutes a day, as a beginning time to commune with the infinite in whatever way that is done, but that means sort of setting aside all of the doing and moving into your being in some kind of what is called contemplative practice. My particular form is with silent meditation and prayer. But some form of, and the key to the practice is that we have to move beyond the content of our experience into the awareness of experience and simply rest in the stillness of that awareness. And as we do that, we begin to grow a garden in our consciousness, a kind of a garden of the soul, if you will. And over time, that garden begins to bear fruit and begins to bring that stillness that we experience in those 20 minutes, then begins to weave throughout the rest of our day and the rest of our life. It doesn't mean that we don't have the same challenges we would have anyway, but what happens is that there begins to weave into our lives a sense of the eternal that is ever present and interpenetrating in each moment of our lives. And that is really beginning to live in what is called the presence of God in the Western or theistic traditions and might be called, Shanti, Paramam, Nirvana, which is the peace that passeth all understanding in the Western tradition or in the Eastern traditions.
Now, a little bit more about mathematics. One of the things that when people say, well, there is no God, there is no spirituality, it's all very materialistic. I just look at something and I know, you know, a thimbleful about mathematics compared to what somebody like yourself knows. But just when I look at the different numbers in nature and the golden mean and all of these different things and these mathematical tolerances for life to exist and all these things. I'm like, oh my gosh, there must be something. There must be something that created all this and is a part of this. I mean, did that map to what you found in mathematics?
Yes. I mean, I think that even if you attribute this to random chance, then one has to bow to random chance as an incredible genius of a process, because look what it created. So even if you dismiss the fact that there's a creative agency and you chalk it up to random chance, then sometimes I like to jokingly say that God could stand for the generalized operating dice, you know, the acronym G-O-D, that are rolled in each moment of the cosmic evolution. And in that sense, even the most committed atheist belongs to God, because were it not for random chance, the atheists would not exist.
An excellent point. An excellent point.
Whatever you attribute creation to, there's no getting around the fact that it is incredibly ingenious. And mathematics is a beautiful example of that. You know, these fractals that I work with, which are a discovery that was only made in the last 25, 30 years, Mandelbrot set, and I go through this in my book, but these are mathematical structures that have infinite complexity, and yet they are created through the simplest mathematical nonlinear processes. And we didn't discover them until the last 30 years, because they were always there. They were there since the beginning of time, really, since the beginning of numbers, because they are inherent in numbers, but we didn't have the capacity to see them without our computing power. And so computers revealed them, but they were always there, innate in the mind of God, if you will, or in the mind of random chance, if you will.
Now, what you're proposing in this book, this is kind of religion agnostic in the sense that it's religion neutral. You could be of any number of religions or no religion and really work with this kind of structure. Is that correct?
That is true. I am basically saying in this book there is a universal path of the heart, a universal path of divine love that exists in all of the traditions and also exists even outside the traditions. Because the traditions came as vehicles to walk that path, but the path itself predates the traditions. This is very important to understand. The path of the heart is a kind of cosmic gift to the human soul. And the religions, even the oldest ones, are only a few thousand years old. So, and the religions in their best are intended to be vehicles for walking that path. But basically, I'm looking at, and because I'm a scientist and because I had to kind of put my whole inquiry into religion and spirituality and square it up with science. And what have I learned from science and how does that apply? So, for example, just to give you an example of that question, one way that I've put this together, in Einstein's relativity theory, in his special relativity theory, he derived the whole thing from just two postulates, which are that the laws of physics are the same in all frames of reference, and the speed of light is a universal constant across all frames of reference. So I basically, if I apply those same postulates to religion, I come up with the idea that the laws of spirituality should be the same in all religions. What is ultimately true about spiritual truth, whatever that is, it must be the same across all the religions. And secondly, the divine light is universal across all religions. And with that posture, and by that second thing is basically demonstrated by essentially interfaith scholarship, where you find that the divine light functions identically in every religion, and that all the religions speak to this kind of supreme, ineffable light that has no shadow and that transcends material existence. And when you see that, then you find that the religions are not mutually contradictory, but mutually complementary. And different religions then are like distinct rays or colors of this universal light. And that taken together, they then affirm a universal spirituality.
Now, what are some, if you're trying to walk this path during life, what are some of the road signs that we get from, and some of the directions we get that are common amongst these different religions, the tenets that kind of go across the board? What are a few of them?
Yeah, basically, there are, for example, this whole principle of relinquishing human desire and coming into alignment with some larger cosmic desire or will. This is a tenet that you see across all the religions. It's sometimes portrayed as, you know, obedience to God's will, which sounds very sort of like punishing. But it's really quite a bit more, it's much more profound than that. It's actually aligning one's life and one's energy with a kind of higher will of life itself. In the Eastern traditions, this would be calling the Dharma, be called the Dharma. You know, you basically align yourself with the Dharma, which is the path to truth. In the Western traditions, you tend to talk more about aligning yourself with the will of God. And this means following, discerning some deeper truth within your own being and then aligning yourself with that. So that's one key piece. A second key piece is what is called faith in the Western traditions. It's called Shraddha in Sanskrit. Shraddha actually has a much deeper meaning than just faith. It's actually the deep convictions of the heart. And this we find across the traditions, and that is the confidence of some profound trust in the unknown, and that there is some ultimate higher purpose to all of existence. And that there is, because really what faith is, in my understanding, is a glimmer in the heart of higher realities. And if you follow that glimmer and kind of lock onto it, what happens is it leads you into those realities and into those realms of divine awakening and into that spiritual kind of presence and essence that I was speaking about earlier. So that's a key piece, is cultivating an actual understanding of faith. This is not a kind of blind belief and acceptance of dogma at all. This is a deeper sense of a trust in the essence of the life force itself, and taking in the data that we have, the fact of life as a self-evident miracle, and then moving into a direct relationship with the hidden mystery of that miracle. And that then becomes a kind of guiding force in our life. It's the same thing that happens when you look in the eyes of a baby and you see something there that is so stirring and so infinite and absolute and moving. And so beginning to connect to that fundamental mystery, that's a key piece. And then the last part, I would say, that's really key across the traditions is this very problematic concept that we call surrender. Surrender, of course, sounds not fun, right? Because it sounds like some kind of humiliating defeat in a battle, right? But really, surrender, better under translated, would be like unconditional consent, that one is basically allowing this process of this transmutational process that takes on place on the most interior aspect of oneself to take place and to let it unfold according to its terms. And then what happens in that process is that there is another force, which is that very miracle of life itself, begins to work us from the inside out and transforms our very consciousness. And so what in short happens, and you see this across the traditions, is that our normal human consciousness is gradually replaced by a higher, more expansive, what we could call divine consciousness. And that's the basic process of spiritual transformation that we see across all the religions.
Now, here's a question for you, and it may or may not be beyond the scope of your book, but it's something that just came up recently in my life, and I always think this is a tough question when it comes to spirituality, whether you're an adherent to a specific religion like Christianity, or if you take a more kind of universalist view. When bad things happen to good people, for example, we just had a family friend who passed with cancer, and this was the latest in a series of health crises. He was a very nice guy, and and just seemed like he had been picked on by the universe. How do we deal with those kind of things? Because you wonder, why do these things happen? Is there a reason that there is this suffering? Or if you see, I'll take an even more extreme case. You see children starving in third world countries. Why is that allowed to happen? How can we make peace with these kind of things when we're looking at living this more spiritual life?
That is a very important question from across the traditions. And one of the stories that I love as a response to that question comes actually from the Baha'i tradition, where there is a man who walks, he's moving through his life, and one day he sees a child starving in the street, and he comes home and he rails against God, why do you allow this to happen? why don't you do something? How can you allow this to be? And so he kind of has that, you know, outrage at God for a few days. And then about a week later, he's sitting by his fireplace in a very comfortable home, you know, have after his warm, full tummy and full meal. And suddenly he hears this very subtle whisper, I did do something. I created you. So basically, he was given the message that that child starving is out of harmony with the cosmic intent and purpose. And I have put in place on this earth the agents who can correct that. And you, my friend, are one of them. And as you sit by your fireplace and do nothing about it, then you are thwarting my will. So my short answer to this is that we each need to find our way to contribute to rewriting the wrongs and the ills in the world. And if we all did our little part, and it doesn't have to be huge, but if we all do our little part and do what's called for, these problems would be transformed. Now, I'm not a Pollyannish person. This isn't going to get rid of all suffering. We're still going to have disease. We're still going to have accidents. We're still going to have things that seem, you know, cosmically unfair. What I can say is that in my own life, when I've had things that go awry and I feel, you know, this is just somehow unjust, even though I may feel that psychologically, I'm still greatly aided by having a spiritual practice that teaches me a kind of unconditional surrender, even in the face of things that seem intolerable, a certain kind of acceptance of what is, regardless of how disagreeable the particular content of what is might seem. There is still great benefit in having cultivated this kind of relationship with spirit, if you will, because it helps us to move through those challenges in life. So my answer to your question is twofold. One, we each need to find what part of healing the world is ours to take on and take it on. And then the second part is that when we do encounter these really challenging aspects, dark energies, having cultivated a relationship, a personal relationship inwardly with what we might call the presence of God, helps us to navigate through those much more skillfully, helps us to keep our balance.
As a scientist and a spiritualist, you kind of have both sides of the house, and you've come to a meeting of the minds within yourself, which is kind of neat. But do you think that spirituality and science are headed toward more unity? Because right now it just seems like you've got the science people over here, you've got the spiritual people over here, and never the twain shall meet, and many times they come at loggerheads. Do you think that that's going to change and evolve over time? Or do you think it is now?
It's definitely evolving over time. And yes, I think there will emerge eventually a magnificent grand synthesis of science and spirituality. And what will come will be a sense of an understanding that science, as we have known it, is really a quest for understanding our outer universe. And spirituality is a quest for understanding our inner universe. And ultimately, there will be a recognition, a profound recognition, that the outer reflects the inner. And so this will be a magnificent kind of tapestry that will be fully awakened to. But at the current moment, we are just beginning to make some headway there. You're probably aware, as many people are, of the, you know, discoveries in physics that seem to align with some of the discoveries of mystics over the years. And the fact that, for example, from quantum physics, we know that time is not absolute. We know that matter is mostly empty space. We have these quantum entanglement that everything is connected to everything else. All of these begin to sound very similar to kind of mystical reports of the inner landscape. And they are. And so there are these strong correlations between the physical, scientific, and the inner spiritual. We still are living, however, with a very strong bias, and this is part of the reason that the twain seemed not to meet, which is really coming out of a reaction to the medieval scholasticism and the dogma and the violations from the religious institutions, you know, 400, 500, 600 years ago. when we had the Inquisition and all of these kinds of incredibly cruel kinds of actions taken in the name of God and justified based on scripture. And, you know, we've had that even in recent times. Apartheid in South Africa, for example, was justified according to scripture. Justified, of course, in quotes, because it can't be justified. But text twisting has always been a trick of the human mind, and you can take any scripture and justify anything with any scripture. You can find parts of it that will justify any kind of action through some kind of twisted thinking. So what we have, and so science was a reaction to that. The whole I think, therefore I am from Descartes was a reaction to that, and an appropriate and needed and healthy reaction. The problem is that now what's happened is that science has become a bit of a, at least the orthodox mainstream materialism has become a bit of a dogma in its own right, and is sharing some of the similar problems that that creates. So what's happened is that science has, if science would stick to what it actually knows and what has actually been proven, it would be fine. But what happens is it extrapolates into areas that it actually doesn't know anything about, such as consciousness. The whole study of consciousness is in its absolute infancy. And so to dismiss consciousness as is done, as a sort of a side effect of neurophysiology in the brain, is basically just a cop-out. And that's now being recognized, finally, more widely, that consciousness is a vast arena requiring a whole new kind of scientific exploration that will also require new kinds of data. This is another very important thing from Karl Popper, one of the great philosophers of science, and where he said new paradigms entail new practices that disclose new kinds of data. The scientific method still applies, the rigor, the independent verification, all of those principles apply, but the data itself is of a completely different kind. And you can't expect with sort of stochastic analysis and statistics to fully lay out the inner territory of consciousness. You've got to have other kinds of data, which we are now getting through contemplative practice, through meditation disciplines, Eastern and Western. And so there's a whole new kind of science that's slowly emerging. It's very exciting and very profound. But it'll take a while for some of the old ways of thinking, you know, to open to this fully. And so there is still a great need for a kind of opening of science to the spiritual domain and vice versa.
Now, for the individual who's looking at getting into a more spiritual way of life, it might look a little daunting. It's like, oh, I've never thought of myself as kind of someone who sits and contemplates the mysteries of the universe, but I do want to investigate this. How can one ease into it, dip their toe into the water and work into it? Is there an accessible way to do that?
Yes, I would say the first of all, if you have any inclination toward any particular tradition, let's say that you found something, you know, useful in the Christian tradition, or maybe you're inclined toward the Buddhist tradition, what I would suggest is to begin by looking for the contemplative practices in those traditions. So, for example, if you're inclined in a Buddhist direction, you could begin with a Vipassana meditation, just going to a weekend retreat. If you're inclined in the Christian tradition or want to somehow have it linked to your own Christian heritage, you could go to what's called a centering prayer retreat. That's also a similar kind of silent practice, but in centering prayer, it's put forward in a Christian context. The truth is, the practice of centering prayer, the practice of Vipassana, the practice of even some of the Dzogchen practices in Buddhism, they're all very similar practices. And the reason I'm recommending these particular kinds of practice is because they take you into the interiority of your own being and your own heart. And this is where, and this is another key, you were asking what are some of the keys across the traditions. This is another key that has emerged from my study and many other studies across the traditions, is that the truth is found within, the deepest truth is found within the depths of your own being. And so to me, the key to really beginning to develop a viable spiritual life is by beginning to do some form of inner inquiry into the essence of yourself within yourself. And that's what these practices are designed to help you do. And so that would be my recommendation, is to find. And there's also, if you're drawn to Islamic practice, some of the Sufi traditions also have these contemplative dimensions of silent prayer, silent practice. Because there's a saying that silence is the first language of God, and all other languages are poor translations. So somehow we need to come into that place that is beyond the ups and downs of daily experience, including experiences and thoughts and ideas that are constantly, you know, rising and falling in our daily life, and come into a place of stable, eternal presence. And the practices of silence will take us to that place.
What is most misunderstood about this path from your experience?
I think most misunderstood are very naive and mistaken concepts of God, of what God refers to, and the deities, the spiritual realm. I think that God, of course, whatever we want to try to define God, God is very difficult to define. But in some sense, the idea that there is a supreme reality of some kind, whether it has a beingness or just an existence that isn't a living being, is an open question. But to recognize that there is an infinite miracle in life, and that the spiritual life is making a personal and direct connection with that miracle of life, I think that is something that has been so misunderstood, and really the religions in many ways have failed their purpose by creating sort of terrifying images of God or deities that frighten people and scare people and oppress people. So there's been many mistakes that have been made, as we are aware, with some of the orthodoxies of religion. Across all the religions we see this. So, in which people are essentially oppressed by the very vehicles that are supposed to lead them to liberation. So we do have those challenges across religions, and I think that those oppressive teachings and practices across various religious traditions have been incredibly damaging and harmful to, in many ways, to the human spirit. And I think that's one of the areas where there's a great, great misunderstanding.
What are the benefits of living a more spiritual life, in your view?
Well, the first one is there's some very practical benefits, one of which is a reduced fear of death. And that one has been clinically demonstrated, that because when one cultivates a relationship to this internal mystery within, one begins to realize, in a way that's kind of beyond the thinking mind, that there's a larger purpose, and one is embedded in a larger cosmic stream of some kind that you can't necessarily articulate in thought, but you can feel it in your being. And it helps you to relax around some of the key questions, like what happens after I die. And in fact, what's now happening that's very auspicious is that there is more and more data now emerging that's actually pointing towards the fact that consciousness, human consciousness, in some sense continues after death. And in my book, I actually make an unusual thing for myself, but I sort of predict that in the next, sometime in this century, and probably in the next few decades, there will be, science will basically come to a recognition of the existence of what we call the soul, in the sense that there is some aspect of human consciousness that survives a physical death, because the data is pointing very strongly in that direction. So that's one part of it, is to recognize that there is an eternal aspect of our being that greatly reduces the fear of death. The second thing I would say is that it helps us to take the simple commands of across all the religions to live in a more loving way, more seriously, and to begin to practice them and implement them in one's life. As you develop a spiritual life, you begin to value love and compassion and caring for other beings more strongly. And those values begin to transform one's experience of life generally, from more of a kind of competing with the day and fighting against the clock to get things done, which of course is still there. It's not that those forces aren't there, but that's all embedded in a larger sense of being in service and in a kind of joyful relationship with the other beings in one's life, not only the loved ones, but also, you know, the plants and the animals in the world. And so there's a kind of, I would say, a more joyful, more easeful way of living, even in the midst of the stress and the tension.
It is a fascinating subject, and one that really pertains to all of us and how we live our lives, whether we choose to live spiritually or not. And our guest today has been Dr. William Keepin. And Dr. Keepin, where can they find the book and also more information about all of your work?
I have a website called pathofdivinelove.org, and that has some of the events we're doing, and also the book is available there, and it's also available certainly on Amazon. It's published by Turner Skylight Path, which is a line from Turner Publishing, so one can look it up on Turner Publishing and buy it that way as well.
Very good. Our guest today has been Dr. William Keepin. The book is Belonging to God, Science, Spirituality, and a Universal Path of Divine Love. Dr. Keepin, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Jim. It's been a joy to be on the program.
And thank you for tuning in, and we certainly hope that you find the path that is right for you. And we hope that path leads back to our program next time. We'll talk to you then. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.